It's now my great pleasure to introduce Rachel Cohn. Rachel is a Canadian who has lived in Australia for the last 30 years. Having got all the requisite academic requirements, she was taken on by the ABC to be their religious broadcasting person. She did quite a lot of variety of programs and so on, but 20 years ago, ABC Radio started up a program called The Spirit of Things. So it's 20 years old, so we're celebrating for Rachel right now. It's a one-hour program every week on religious matters. It's just the most wonderful job in the world, because in 20 years, you just count up the number of weeks, she's able to explore a whole range of things. At the end of October, the last 2 one-hour sessions were Martin Luther, Catholic dissident, and the X Factor in the Reformation. And there is another one coming up. You can find them on the website and listen to them. It's extraordinary, and I suggest that we might take an hour out of our week from now on to listen to the back numbers of the ABC. Rachel's no stranger to Sea of Faith. She's been to two of our conferences, the most recent one of which was at Lindisfarne in Hastings in 2013. She was a presenter there. She's written a couple of books, one called The New Believers, and another one that I would like to get hold of called Curious Obsessions in the History of Science and Spirituality. So, with no further ado, we have Rachel to talk to us now. Lloyd has a wide and deep background in matters of Christianity and faith, and I think we're very fortunate to have Rachel, who has a very wide and deepening, only 30 years, background in similar matters. Rachel, you're very welcome to talk to us.
Thank you very much. First of all, I'd like to pay tribute to two extraordinary men, Lloyd Gearing's just astounding long life pursuing theology as one of the greatest kinds of revenge you can have for being tried for heresy, I imagine. And secondly, Noel Cheer, who most certainly lives up to his name and has been able to bring great cheer and enjoyment and depth into the public discussions on religion and spirituality and post-religion as well. I also want to pay tribute to the immensely organized Gretchen Cavell, who's just made my arrival and stay here just a delight, and of course to you all for coming here. Now, can you hear me well enough? Yes? Okay. Reformation is a loaded word. What do you think of when you hear it? A sweeping program of change that rewrites the foundation of faith and changes society. I'm sure that most of you here think about the Protestant Reformation of the 16th century, whose high point was the nailing of the 95 Theses on the door of the Wittenberg Cathedral by the author Martin Luther, or Luder, as he was originally called. But that is a fiction. There was no nailing of the list of complaints on any door. According to historians, that was a legend concocted many years later and enshrined centuries afterward in masterful works of art to make Luther look like a self-conscious hero. The 95 Theses were indeed written and circulated and did become the basis of Luther's secession from selected Catholic beliefs and practices that had built up over the centuries that he regarded as unchristian and a complete departure from the plain truth of the scriptures. And Lloyd Gearing outlined the main one being the selling of places in heaven. But Protestantism, which we take as the gold standard of religious reformation because it resulted in the creation of a new church, was not the intention of Luther, as Lloyd again made clear yesterday. He hoped it would reform the Catholic Church from the inside instead of developing a new institution alongside of it. The Augustinian friar and Bible teacher and married layman died a Catholic. Indeed, the Reformation would result in far more than one church establishing itself as the true faith. It unleashed hundreds of rival theologies, churches, sects, and movements. The concept of the Holy Spirit alone would become a highly contested and powerful force in the Protestant era, by which I mean the centuries that emerged after Martin Luther, John Calvin, John Wesley, and John Knox. Was the Holy Spirit a force that spoke to each and every Christian? Did it indwell in themselves, as the Quakers believed, or did it aid in the right interpretation of Scripture? Did it speak to the lowly and the depraved, or did it communicate only to the righteous? These are questions that still remain alive today. In any case, as Protestants memorialized the Reformation ever after, it was the Holy Spirit that moved great men to cleanse the church of evil beliefs and practices of corrupt men who had strayed far from God and brought his house into disrepute, indeed had allowed it to slide into the grip of Satan. Luther, of course, regularly referred to the Pope as the Antichrist. This view is not untypical of all Reformation movements, which are champing at the bit for change, and which claim to represent populations who are aggrieved and feel downtrodden by the elite. This was certainly the way the German people felt when the Holy Roman Empire regularly tapped them for taxes and expensive indulgences, which it used to wage wars and also to build the extravagant cathedrals, none more grand than St. Peter's in Rome, and of course the Apostolic Palace in the Vatican. Luther's theology swept away the need for priests and orders, their buildings and lands. A large hierarchy was dismantled, and the breakaway churches no longer supported celibate populations of monks, friars, and nuns. They got married, took real jobs, and some preached sermons in churches. A major reformation had been accomplished in parts of Northern Europe, including the establishment of schools for the populace housed in disused monasteries and cloisters, which was the wish of Luther, who promoted this. This structural reformation, which incidentally would later spawn established churches representing the official creed of particular nations, is the kind of historic change that more easily etches itself in the collective memory as momentous. What does not make it into the popular mind is the simple fact that the Catholic Church was theologically not as monolithic as it seemed, and neither was it structurally uniform. Much of what Protestantism achieved was possible because of this. The orders of the Catholic Church were often rivals and sometimes mortal enemies, as were the Franciscan and Dominican orders. They viewed their roles in the world very differently, according to distinct theologies and callings or charisms and practices. Just think of the Jesuit missionaries to India and China, who were driven by curiosity and also fascination as much as they were by the desire to convert. They became the great conveyors of other cultures and beliefs to the West, which in turn helped us understand that the heathen actually had some things to teach us. But that is another story. Reformation of a momentous kind had already occurred among the Jews of antiquity. It is perhaps the most impressive example of change which thoroughly altered the orthodoxy and orthopraxis of the biblical religion of Israel, not once, but twice. Initially, with the destruction of the first temple of Jerusalem in the 6th century BCE, a large population of Jews were removed to Babylon. There, amongst the Persian-speaking peoples, they dwelt, absorbing the surrounding culture and language, and became the place where the biblical and rabbinic texts were written. When Cyrus, the king of Persia, gave them leave to return to Israel, the land of their forefathers, some returned, and they rebuilt the temple. The priestly class of the Kohanim and their assistants, the Levites, were once again installed in the role of keepers of the priestly cult of the Second Temple. But something had already begun to happen among the Israelites who had followed their Jewish tradition without the aid of a temple priestly cult in the diaspora, including, of course, the population, the very significant population in Egypt, which produced the Jewish philosopher Philo. They gathered for weekly readings of the scriptures in the synagogues, the places they met, to recite the Torah. Israel today, if you have visited it, has remarkable archaeological sites of ancient synagogues replete with mosaic floors, illustrated in biblical and astrological motifs. Jews before the Common Era were already engaged in administering the law to a community that was now living in changed circumstances. Interpretations of the law were paramount and by no means self-evident. Yet Judaism did not install a final adjudicator like a pope, since it was the Torah itself that was the word of God, the voice of God, and consequently no one could be elevated above it. And in a remarkable rabbinic ruling, no one could be said to have heard the voice of God, the Bat Kol, talking to them. It was for the people to discern, discuss, and debate the Torah. And as some have argued, notably Saul Lieberman in his very famous book, published in 1942, called Greek and Jewish Palestine, the teachers, called rabbis, followed the pattern of the Greek schools of philosophy, discussing and debating points of law and ethics, but leaving open-ended the possible right opinion. The Talmud was born, a commentary on the Torah containing a core legal text, or the Mishnah, and discussions concerning it and other parts of the Bible, as well as some standalone sections like the ethical treatise, Perkei Avot, or the sayings of the fathers. This formed the template of what was a reformation in Judaism. It was instigated, to be sure, by the subjugation of Israel's conquerors, who took their land and enslaved them. But when the temple fell for the second time in 70 CE under the Romans, the Jewish people had already undertaken major revisions to their religion. A further catalyst was a new class of scholars and rabbis who accused the temple priests of being corrupt puppets of a foreign power, living richly while the people suffered. Jesus was influenced by these critics and became one of them. Still, The destruction of the Second Temple was by no means welcomed by the Jewish people, since it was the house of God where the Ark of the Covenant was held and where precious symbols of their ancient faith were installed. However, Rabbinic Judaism was already standing in the wings, ready to sustain the people in what would be a politically unstable and uncertain future for almost two millennia. Their lodestar was God's written and oral Torah, which offered the day-to-day structure of their lives and in prayer pointed them toward Israel, their homeland. The scriptures were read each week in the synagogue, rituals permeated domestic life, and the prayers were recited each day at sunrise and sunset. Nonetheless, Jewish thinking and practice underwent subsequent reformations in the diaspora, developing a strong mystical tradition in 13th century Spain that spread throughout Europe and also in Israel, where Jews returned and established themselves in towns around the Galilee like Sfat and Tiberias. The Hasidic movement, which spread like a prairie fire in 18th century Lithuania and Poland, had strong parallels to the Wesleyan Protestant movement, particularly in its focus on music, ecstatic prayer, itinerant preachers, humility, and love. At its heart was a rejection of the elitist, scholastic formalism of the rabbinic tradition, and an attempt to recapture the simple piety and enthusiastic worship of a Jewish life. It's captured in the story, by the way, and of course Hasidic Judaism is well known for its storytelling, kind of like parables. And the well-known story of the illiterate Jew who didn't go to synagogue because he was embarrassed that he didn't know the prayer encounters a Hasidic rabbi or rebbe, as they were called, teachers, who said, "Do you know the Aleph Beit, the alphabet?" "Yes," he said. "Well, then just go in and say the Aleph Beit, the alphabet, and God will rearrange the letters into prayers." So that underlines how important the Hasidic movement was for the illiterate Jewish peasant, the person who was not highly educated, who maybe didn't even know the prayers to say. Among the more urbanized Jews in 19th century Lithuania, the Musar movement focused on ethics and education with parallels in post-Enlightenment England and Europe. The Enlightenment had its Jewish parallel called the Haskalah, and the new school of Reform Judaism entirely reflected 19th century rationalism in its founding Pittsburgh platform of the 1840s, resembling similar Christian liberal movements such as Unitarianism. In America, Reform would become the dominant form of Judaism, and to this day, it has not stood still in adapting to cultural and social changes in the modern West. More of that later. Islam also underwent a major Reformation period in the 9th to the 11th centuries, and it was influenced by Greek philosophy. Ijtihad, the term for reasoning, was championed by Muslim philosophers such as the Neoplatonist Al-Kindi and the 10th century Al-Farabi, who had extensive exposure to Western thinkers or Greek philosophy and translated their works into Arabic. And in fact, many of the translators were Arabic-speaking Jews in Muslim lands, particularly in Spain. The most famous Aristotelian, the 11th century Muslim, Avicenna, founded a Neoplatonic school of thought, but later the influence of Al-Ghazali, much quoted these days, who emphasized devotion led to a decline in philosophical reform due to Al-Ghazali's argument that religion was incompatible with philosophy. Ibn Rushd, or Averroes as he is known, on the other hand, defended philosophy and had to flee Andalusia to save his life. But Islam's early schism, however, into the Shiite and Sunni traditions, which occurred in the first generation after Muhammad, meant that they developed quite different and separate responses to the great religious and philosophical questions, especially in the early modern period. Shiism, or the Shiite sect, was more open to mysticism, essentialism, and miraculous stories surrounding the lives of the saints. This has contemporary expressions, which I'll mention later. The Islamic movement known as Sufism flourished in Spain in the 13th century to the 16th centuries, and, as you recall, so did Jewish mysticism at the same time, in the same area, and it has been linked. They have been linked very closely, that the emergence of the Kabbalah or Jewish mysticism was very influenced by Sufism, Islamic mysticism, and it's hard to tell which came first. The great current scholar on the Kabbalah, Daniel Matt, who has translated the Zohar in the most important critical edition, is one of those who has argued this, as has Gershom Scholem, the great scholar of Jewish mysticism. Well, among the world's great religions, Buddhism experienced some of the most momentous reformations in its 2,500-year history. Originating in the 5th century BCE, in the northeastern part of India, Buddhism spread across to the east, far east. Everywhere it went, it came up against local cultures and developed many contrasting expressions. Buddhism's beginnings are recounted in the story of the life of an Indian prince, Siddhartha Gautama, from Lumbini, which is in Nepal, of the Shakya clan, which is why he is referred to as Shakyamuni. He renounced his worldly life to follow a spiritual path of simplicity and meditation that delivered a state of enlightenment or Buddhahood. He emphasized the need for compassion to all sentient beings. His movement is most definitely a reaction to Hinduism, and yet it nonetheless continues some of Hinduism's most central beliefs. Records of the first and second councils held in the 5th and 4th centuries BCE respectively reveal the institutional self-organization of Buddhism, but in the 3rd century BCE, under King Ashoka, who converted to Buddhism, a third council was called, and he set about spreading the faith beyond the Ganges Valley. Ashoka's encounter with the Greeks, who reached the Indus Valley under Alexander the Great, not only encouraged him to spread Buddhism among them and as far west as Macedonia, but under Greek influence, the Buddha was for the first time depicted and represented in sculptural form. Before that, only a footprint was allowed to represent the Buddha. Of course, the Bamiyan Buddhas in central Afghanistan, which were the high point of representation of the Buddha, being gigantic seated figures, Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, who are saints, were blown up by the Taliban in March 2001. Buddhism underwent a major reformation in the first century CE with the emergence of the Mahayana school. In contrast to the Theravada school, those names carry the triumphalist nature of the Reformation, which deemed the new form of Buddhism the great vehicle and the earlier form the small vehicle. In a nutshell, the Buddhist Reformation was an anti-clerical movement which brought hope and salvation to the lay people. Are you seeing a theme here? Mahayana Buddhism not only held that it was not necessary to become an ascetic, celibate monk to experience the rebirth in the Western heaven, but also that monks could go out into the world and put off their own salvation or enlightenment in order to help raise up the spiritual merit of the laity. This broke down the barrier that had grown up between the elite, self-serving monks and the people. The impact was immediate. Monks readily became much more a part of the community, and Buddhism quickly spread, especially to the Far East, to Korea, Japan, and China. Much later, in the 5th century, another form of Buddhism emerged called the Thunderbolt or Vajrayana tradition, combining Lamaism, which is the incarnation of a deity in human form and reflected the Hindu belief in avatars, which are gods in human form, and a combination of that and Tantra, which is an esoteric school of Hinduism having to do with sort of sexual concepts. Vajrayana became the form of Buddhism associated exclusively with Tibet in later centuries, and of course the Dalai Lama belongs to one of its schools. Today, the Dalai Lama has initiated some very significant modernizing reforms, such as the secular education of monks, especially in science being one. These historical moments of reformation in the world's religions have not gone unnoticed in the modern world. They remain influential, and by their example have served as templates for further reforms in these religions as they respond to the changed circumstances of the 20th and 21st centuries. German Protestantism responded quickly to the Enlightenment and developed scientific and rationalist analyses of the scriptures and has evolved theologically away from a literalist to more often a metaphorical interpretation of the Bible. It has also developed its ecclesiology and theology to incorporate or respond to the rise of gender egalitarianism. And in the third millennium, it has renewed the importance of spiritual experience and introduced reforms into Christian practice. The popularity of the World Community for Christian Meditation, which some of you may know here, the WCCM, under the leadership of Father Lawrence Freeman, a Benedictine English monk, is a case in point where a new space has opened up for Christians who are less attracted to the sacraments and liturgy, and perhaps even have minimal familiarity with the Bible. One could call it a Christian form of mindfulness meditation, a term I'm sure you've heard of, which is a term that Lawrence Freeman sometimes uses when he addresses audiences, including corporate businessmen, which he does increasingly. Perhaps the most important expression of this combination of spiritual experience and little interest in liturgy and theology is Pentecostalism or charismatic Christianity, in which the free access to the Holy Spirit has a transforming effect. Theology is downplayed, as is ritual and sacrament, whereas the experience of faith is primarily a personal encounter with divinity. Well, that's not new, but there is a millennial version of it that has made enormous headway. The Hillsong phenomenon epitomizes the most recent form of this kind of Christian faith, employing contemporary music, new songs delivered in a rock band format, which encourages the flowing emotions, usually of joy, love, and weeping. Hillsong's reach is worldwide, and at its annual conference, it draws 30,000 people. It also attracts celebrities such as Justin Bieber, Guy Sebastian, and the NBA star Kevin Durant, as well as many other high-profile entertainers. Compare that to this gathering. I'm not saying theirs is better, just compare. Although Hillsong is highly commercialized, being an integrated part of the music industry and other businesses, it is precisely because of this that it speaks to the contemporary generation and culture, which is not only at home with pop music, but is also conditioned to treat all things of value as commercial transactions. Hymns are no longer sung from the old song sheets, but you can buy the CDs of your favorite Christian bands online. If Luther railed against the church in his day for selling places in heaven, in stark contrast, today's Western Christians expect to be able to buy goods and services that pertain to their spiritual life. Christian TV or televangelism has established this as a mainstream phenomenon now for, 30, 40 years? For example, the Benny Hinn prosperity gospel that sees the Hinn family jet around the world in their private Gulfstream aircraft. To be sure, in the most recent edition of Christianity Today, there was an article about one of the sons who realized it was all a fraud, but only after the investigators came in and caught them out. But he is certainly showing the hollow side of that kind of faith. The hollow side of that faith. I'm not saying that all of that faith is hollow, but that particular expression of it is, when it's fraudulent. It is a fact, however, that many of today's Christians are uninterested in theological concepts or in moral arguments that are linked to salvation. It's too hard. Try mentioning the word morality to anyone under 50. Everyone gets hot under the collar and starts screaming. Instead, they prefer to experience a little bit of heaven right now in the form of ecstatic worship and prayer. For people who've suffered addiction, for example, handing their life over to an all-powerful and loving God and keeping that channel of communication open to Him is more than enough to be thankful for, and it keeps them healthy and living. And for ordinary folk, nurses, teachers, retail salespeople, living in a highly secular society in which they increasingly feel perhaps alien and alone. It is a welcome alternative to the day-to-day routine and demands of their world. Catholicism has responded to the historic catastrophes of the 20th century with some profound theological reflection and change. The formerly exclusive view of truth and God, which cast all other religions in the basket of ignorance and damnation, has changed, at least formally, since its proclamation of Nostra Aetate in 1965. In particular, its relationship to Judaism and the Jewish people has become visibly positive and respectful, replacing a view that Jews are cursed and deserving of a life of suffering and enslavement. It was a view, by the way, epitomized in the pamphlet called Jews and Their Lies, written by the Catholic dissident Martin Luther, and now used by neo-Nazis all over the world on their websites. Just Google the Jews and Their Lies. You'll come up with these neo-Nazi websites, quoting Luther, of course, because he wrote it. By the way, Goebbels used that document and used Luther in his self-defense at Nuremberg. The major reformation of the Second Vatican Council also had the effect of prompting many clergy to leave the church because reforms did not go far enough. Indeed, further calls by women clamoring for ordination and calling for married priests have met largely with stubborn refusal to entertain systematic change. So, in some cases, like the women priests that began in Germany, Catholic women theologians have just gone ahead and become ordained, usually in secret by existing Catholic bishops. And they minister to churches that are outside of the official Catholic Church's sanction. And they exist in America and Germany and in other places. Yet in this 500th anniversary of the Protestant Reformation, the Lutheran and Catholic churches are joining forces across Europe in celebration and commemoration. This is surely a significant development. Indeed, Luther's rejection of the sale of indulgences, that is, the church selling places in heaven, was long ago dropped by the Catholic Church in its theology and practice. Catholics today would agree with Luther on many points, as indeed did Pope Benedict. And in an edition of the National Catholic Reporter in America some years ago, I read the headline, "Is it time to beatify Luther?" It was pretty amazing. Many Catholics would agree with Luther that the insistence on unmarried celibate priests is antiquated. And if one were to take account of many of the left-wing Catholic critics today about certain recent popes, like John Paul II and Pope Benedict, they would not be far off Luther's very colorful epithets. Catholicism today, just as in Europe of the 16th century, exhibits the full spectrum of views, minus the Inquisition's fiery methods of staunching criticism. In a recent edition of the National Catholic Reporter, Father John Martin, the Jesuit editor of one of the leading intellectual and social commentary magazines, America, wrote about gays in the church. His view, as clearly announced by the title of his latest book, building a bridge, how the Catholic Church and the LGBT community can enter into a relationship of respect, compassion, and sensitivity, brought some predictable results. On the one hand, there was a battle between liberal and conservative bishops. Some canceled his talks in various dioceses, while other bishops protested that decision. Similarly, Pope Francis has received a letter of correction from a number of bishops who feel he has been too ambiguous, read liberal, on a number of theological points, and they demanded that he rein in his views. But for feminist Catholics, such as the former New South Wales Premier, Christina Keneally, who has a higher degree in systematic Catholic theology, the Pope hasn't done a single thing to progress change other than revamp the Vatican Bank. And that was in the hands, by the way, of Cardinal Pell of Australia. Women and the Australian Church, WATAC, which began around the time I arrived in Australia 30 years ago, keeps alive feminist aspirations, including women's ordination in the Catholic Church, but it remains really a home for hopes rather than realities. And that is the condition of our religious culture in the West today. Despite the existence of churches which appear to be monolithic, they are subject to checks and balances, ginger groups, and not to mention the unfettered assault of the media. Catholics, like other Christians, notably the Anglicans and the Uniting Church in Australia, can be found anywhere on the spectrum from left to right, because faith is essentially legitimized at the individual level. No one will be burned at the stake for their views, and they know it. The Ecclesia, however, continues to float, perhaps with little obvious direction, being more of a symbol of the faith rather than generating new faith, in the West, that is. Judaism has kept pace with change on almost every front, from women's ordination to the acceptance of same-sex marriage by progressive or reform Jews. There are commitment ceremonies, for example, in reform synagogues for same-sex couples. Orthodoxy does not endorse homosexuality, but neither does it punish or exclude homosexuals from active involvement in synagogue life. However, the ultra-Orthodox minority of Jews are completely resistant to change, and I'm always curious that whenever they show Israel, they only ever show this minority of ultra-Orthodox Jews. Indeed, they appear to dig in deeper as the faith liberalizes its responses to the modern world. But that is like every religion, every ideology. It's the law of opposites. Women have been ordained since the 1970s in the Reform, Reconstructionist, and conservative traditions of Judaism. And last year, there's even been a change in at least one Orthodox Jewish community in New York, which ordains women now. Now they can go up to the Bima, that is where the Torah lies open, and they can read from it and give instruction to both men and women. But interestingly, Jewish reforms are not always in the direction of dilution, which is how modernity is so often characterized. For example, it's rediscovered some rituals that it had rejected in the early modern era as outdated. The mikveh, or immersion in the ritual bath, which women were obliged to use after their menstrual periods and men used prior to the Sabbath, is returning in some reform settings as a means of experiencing renewal. It's strictly voluntary, of course, with both men and women, finding that the experience of immersion not only symbolizes the washing away of the impurities of mind and heart, but it also prepares them for the celebration of the Sabbath. Judaism has also welcomed the return of the mystical teachings and practices of the Kabbalah, once thought to be superstitious medievalism. And it has also developed another stream called renewal, which pointedly combines Kabbalah, meditation, guitar music, and holistic health. Sounds pretty much like the return of the hippies. But the focus again is primarily experience. Other reforms reflect changed social realities, such as the relatively small number of Jews in the world and the incidence of intermarriage. Matrilineal descent, as a way of identifying as Jewish, has now made way for patrilineal descent in the Reformed tradition. If you have a Jewish father and a Christian mother and wish to live a Jewish life, you're a Jew. That's a major change. Buddhists have enormous difficulty changing the patriarchal monastic system in traditional countries like Sri Lanka, Thailand, and Burma. In fact, a parallel to selling indulgences exists in these countries, and most especially in Thailand. If you've ever been to Bangkok and seen the Dharmakaya stupa, it's a giant gold-colored stupa covered, if you come up close, with millions of little Buddhas, which you can buy at the storefront to raise your merit. But the Dharmakaya stupa and the monastic, the Sangha, the monastic order that runs it, have been under investigation periodically for the last 20 years. Every now and then it comes back in the news for corruption and money-making schemes. So, you know, it wasn't just the Catholic Church that was selling places in heaven. The Theravadan tradition has been doing the same in some places. But in recent years, there's been a major development in Taiwan when Zheng Yan, a Buddhist nun, founded Siji, C-I-J-I, in 1966. She built a billion-dollar-plus service organization to the poor based on her own changed version of Pure Land Buddhism into something resembling a realized eschatology, a Pure Land that is a heaven on earth. Zheng Yan was keen for Buddhism to respond to social deprivation, rather than to simply generate hopes of being reborn in the Pure Land, the Buddhist heaven. In fact, she was influenced by two Catholic nuns and adopted their social justice ethic to improve the lot of suffering in her country. Her worldwide empire is now involved in everything from schools and farming to bone marrow donations and hospitals, linking a network of Chinese followers and supporters globally. What's unusual is that it is primarily a female organization. 8 million lay women make up 80% of Siji's membership, yet when men who are welcomed into it come in, they are expected to actually take on the gentle, soft-spoken, compassionate characteristics of women, including weeping together. This is a major paradigm shift in what is a patriarchal Chinese culture. In the West, we see that Buddhism has either secularized through the offering of mindfulness meditation, or it has developed into egalitarian modes and democratic taking on democratic values in the iconoclastic school of Zen Buddhism, which has ordained women spiritual leaders or roshis. But today, of course, the call to reform is most often mentioned in relation to Islam. Numerous women scholars and journalists have been at the forefront of this call, as they have the most to gain and the least to lose. Ida Lichter, a friend of mine who has been a leading commentator on this subject, published Muslim Women Reformers about 5 years ago. It's a virtual encyclopedic compendium of women around the world who have fought for change. Women who've been the most active in publishing studies that challenge the received interpretations of the Quran, modifying practices, establishing mixed prayers for men and women together, and speaking out for the education of girls and against underage marriage and the practice of FGM, have been courageous because their lives are in danger. You probably know Malala Yousafzai from Pakistan, Irshad Manji from Canada, and of course, Ayan Hirsi Ali from Somalia, Holland, and England. There are also women imams and scholars like Amina Wadud, the Black American who has led prayers at great peril to herself, having experienced bomb threats. Some of these women take inspiration from the Sufi tradition, a relatively small sect, which has had famous women teachers nonetheless. But in Australia, such reformist voices are almost non-existent. In a recent book by a convert, Susan Carland, the wife of Waleed Ali, a Muslim broadcaster and academic, in her book, none of the Muslim women in Australia who complained about certain aspects of their faith agreed to be named. All of them were under pseudonyms. Reformist movements in Islam are by their nature like individual currents in a big sea of faith, for the simple reason that Islam is not centralized, and as noted before, it is divided into rival schools, locked in deadly battles. However, in today's world, the approach taken by Fethullah Gulen, the Turkish Sunni spiritual leader with links to the Sufi Nur sect, is a businessman who gives his name to a worldwide movement, and it's kind of instructive. He lives in Pennsylvania in relative hiding. Fethullah Gulen, also known as the Gulen Hizmet movement, is avowedly modern and believes Islam is fully compatible with modernity, the sciences, and peaceful coexistence with other religions, mainly Christianity and Judaism. It focuses on education, establishing a vast array of elite secondary schools, colleges, and universities, media stations, as well as interfaith organizations, which is how you might encounter them. But they go under a variety of innocuous names, not Fethullah Gulen, like Harmony and Concord and so forth. Critics of Fethullah Gulen say that underneath the outward modernity lies a desire to establish a worldwide caliphate, and under a veneer of interfaith relationships lies Fethullah Gulen's own negative view of other religions, which, by the way, is evident in his Turkish writings. The secretive nature and multi-billion dollar reach of Fethullah Gulen's businesses and organizations cannot help but raise suspicion and mistrust. By the way, Fethullah Gulen is worth how much do you think? $25 billion today, and they're all over the world. There have been studies done on Fethullah Gulen, so you can by academics, so they tend to be fairly reliable. Reformation, however, is not always undertaken for the right reasons, nor does it always have the best outcomes. Historically, there have been some disastrous attempts at reformation. The so-called German faith movement leading up to the Third Reich is one such example. ISIS and its call for the worldwide caliphate is another, but in this case, one would not necessarily call it a reformation, more like a violent insurrection that is hoping to be a reformation. The concern, however, is how will this declared desire to establish a caliphate impact on the rest of the world, and how will it influence other forms of Islam? That is an open question. In any case, today's Western world is not fertile ground for a real reformation, for at least two reasons. On the one hand, any given society is spoiled for choice with the sheer multiplicity of religions and cultures on offer. A patriarchal type of Buddhism is easily thrown over for another brand that is friendlier to women. Heresy and expulsion are not common in Catholicism, unless you draw a lot of attention to yourself. So finding yourself a church that turns a blind eye to divorced people or gay couples during Holy Communion is not going to be hard. But there's another reason why there's little urgency to reform religion, and that is the sheer ease with which one can opt out of formal religion, live in a secular society, and partake of whatever spiritual practices you find comfortable and available, like the Sea of Faith or humanistic Judaism. The no religion category is not actually without spiritual aspirations or needs, which can be satisfied in some way without formal membership. Secular society is precisely what Ayaan Hirsi Ali and many Muslims have opted for, given the reformation of Islam is more difficult and less organized and not as far along on the ground as it is among some scholars that I've mentioned. Who knows? Ali and others might be partaking in yoga and Buddhist meditation. I know a Somali Muslim woman, Mariam Issa, in Melbourne, who has taken enormous inspiration from Buddhist meditation and teachings while still wearing her turban and speaking about a kind of existentialist Islam. Her organization, Helping Muslim Women, is called RAW, Resilient Active Women. The default position of no religion is very likely where I believe many will rest until they find something that is more relevant to their spiritual needs. Indeed, if there's going to be a really significant reformation in religion, it will play out in Islam. Not all of it, but in the sector that is willing and able to change. And this reformation is not likely to be the result of simply emulating liberal Christians. That's just assimilation. More likely, it will be a considered response to the extremes of ISIS, which has virtually hijacked Islam and given it a very bad name, not only in the West, but the world over. It is apocalyptic and savage, and if Islam is to have any friends and followers in the modern West, it has to thoroughly distance itself from its form of Islam. But the rise of Islamic televangelism will make the spread of ISIS and its sympathizers much more likely and more difficult to stem. Religion is here to stay, but it never stays put. Where it will go in the future is anyone's guess. But globalization through technology will play a very big role, as well as the reactions against it. We will just have to watch this space and hope for the best. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Rachel. You've broadened our understanding of this word, reformation, and we will be more alert to it in all the religions you've been talking about. But particularly, thank you for talking about Islam. It really is forefronts of our minds as well. I hope you will join one of the core groups, and I hope if Sue and Hal are here this morning, they will join a core group too. Whenever Lloyd is at, he's not here this morning, but whenever he's here, he always joins a core group, and he doesn't mind joining in and giving his penny worth as well. So you are very welcome to do that. This is to say thank you. We look forward to hearing you again at the panel discussion tomorrow. So one of the things that we are off to core groups to do now is to have a really good discussion about what you've talked about and think about what to ask you next.